You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison's current class of police recruits recently underwent training to understand the effects of mental illness and how to respond to those suffering from a mental health crisis. A WPR reporter joins us to talk about what they learned.
First, another political controversy appears to be brewing in the Trump administration. At issue here are the potential actions of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Last week, The Washington Post reported that Flynn privately discussed U.S. sanctions against Russia with that country's ambassador to the U.S. during the month before President Trump took office. It's a potentially illegal action that Flynn initially denied.
While no action has been taken against Flynn so far, many Republicans did not appear to defend him over the weekend, raising questions about his future in the Trump administration, though we've been hearing in the news, Trump spokesperson Kellyanne Conway has said that he has the support of the president. Meanwhile, Democratic leaders are calling for investigations into the actions as well as a suspension of Flynn's security clearance.
Dan DeLuce joins us now. He's chief national security correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, what we're hearing right now is that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn has apologized to Vice President Mike Pence for discussing U.S. sanctions against Russia with the Russian ambassador in the days leading up to when President Trump took office. What do we know about this phone call in late December?
Well, thanks to the Washington Post, we know that he spoke to the Russian ambassador several times. And the timing itself raised a lot of red flags because it was precisely when the outgoing Obama administration was preparing to announce a new round of sanctions on Russia to punish Moscow over its interference in the elections in the United States, which the U.S. intelligence community concluded definitely did occur. And there was this hacking into aides of Hillary Clinton that the Clinton campaign's eyes damaged her standing during the campaign.
And so what has Russia said about this conversation or these series of conversations?
Russia has not said that sanctions were discussed, but other officials in the administration and intelligence officials told the Washington Post that sanctions apparently were raised, that the subject did come up, and that there was kind of a message being sent by Flynn, to Russia, don't worry, when we come into office in a few weeks, we're not going to be putting pressure on you like this. So the impression was left, according to these accounts, that Russia could expect not to be penalized. And then what really raised suspicions was following those phone calls and the sanctions from the U.S. were announced by the Obama White House, Russia did not retaliate, which was completely breaking with sort of normal, customary game, the way the game is played, where Russia would have then retaliated in some way against the U.S.
Is it unusual at all for an incoming advisor to have contact with a foreign dignitary?
Not necessarily. Probably what would not be considered customary would be to contradict the policies being articulated by the current administration in power and to be basically indicating something contrary. It's one thing to have contacts, to have conversations, to say, let's have a meeting of our two heads of state once the new president is inaugurated and so on and so forth. It's another thing to say, to basically, reportedly, as this report indicates, to be undermining, to be somehow even sabotaging the current president's policies.
And Democratic leaders have called for investigations that Flynn did something illegal here. Talk about the legality or illegality of what might have happened. And does this violate this Logan Act? Tell us about that.
Well, that's a very interesting and tricky legal question because, yes, there is a Logan Act which prohibits private citizens from conducting foreign policy, essentially, or somehow making promises on behalf of the U.S. government. But that was that is a very old law. It's arcane. It dates back to 1799. No one's ever been convicted on that law. So the FBI would be in kind of uncharted territory if it tried to make a case against Flynn under the Logan Act. However, There are other criminal statutes, federal criminal law, that he could be perhaps found in violation of if he was somehow found to be making reassurances or somehow taking direction from a foreign power. The thing that tends to trip people up, actually, is lying to federal investigators. Mm. So if there was a federal investigation and he was found to be making false statements to investigators, then he would be in hot water.
We're talking with Dan DeLuce. He's chief national security correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine, talking about the controversy over National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's discussion of sanctions with a Russian ambassador before President Trump took office. Now, the Trump administration recently, in very recent minutes, perhaps, Kellyanne Conway saying that the administration has the backing of the Trump administration. How is President Trump handling this situation?
Well, that's very interesting because you had a sort of radio silence since Friday, where when one of the senior advisors in the White House, Stephen Miller, was asked directly about this on the Sunday talk shows, he declined to say that the president had confidence in Flynn. He sort of dodged the question.
Mm-hmm.
But Kellyanne Conway, you're right, today did explicitly say the president has confidence in him. So what's interesting here is they seem to be now coming to his defense. And for 3 days, there was a big question mark, and it fed all this speculation that maybe Flynn would have to leave because somehow he had misled the vice president and put the vice president in an awkward position when he got asked about this. I will say this, though. If Flynn stays in the job, this whole episode has reinforced a lot of suspicions and concern about where the administration is going on its Russia policy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of Republicans in Congress, not just Democrats. You have Republican senators who are very concerned about the possibility of some kind of conciliatory policy where the sanctions might be lifted without getting much in return. And so you've had Senator McCain and Graham and some others kind of warning the White House not to go down that path. And there's even a proposed bipartisan bill that says that any lifting of sanctions will have to come under the review of the Senate. So the White House is possibly on a collision course with its own party in Congress, depending on which way they go.
And meanwhile, Democratic leaders are calling on President Trump to suspend and revoke Flynn's security clearance. Is this something you think we'll see any action on, any traction?
Not when it's coming from the Democrats. I think Flynn is under scrutiny. The White House is under a lot of scrutiny over this. But a lot will hinge on what the Republican majority in the Senate says about all of this. I think if the Democrats say it, it could turn into more of a partisan kind of dynamic. But what is true, again, is if Flynn stays in his position, the White House will still be under a lot of pressure over where it's going with its policy on Russia. And I think it will make a lot of Republicans in Congress very anxious if they do move to lift sanctions on Russia in a way that's perceived to be kind of unilateral, that there really isn't much gotten in return.
And Dan, before we let you go here, what are you watching for in the coming days and weeks when it comes to Russia and the U.S. moving forward?
Well, I think that is a huge question. What does this administration plan to do on Russia? And we really don't know. And they've offered some mixed signals. So, for example, at the UN, the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, was sounding a harder line, saying that sanctions on Russia should stay in place over its invasion and seizure of the Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine. But she did not talk about the sanctions that were imposed on Russia over its interference in eastern Ukraine, where they've supported these pro-separatist elements there. And those sanctions are very tough and have hit different sectors of the Russian economy. So there's still a question of whether the Trump White House will decide to somehow forge some new deal, some arrangement with Russia where they lift those sanctions. And they've talked about, well, perhaps we would then cooperate with Russia in Syria. But that's been a pretty difficult thing to do, and it didn't seem to go anywhere under the Obama White House.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dan DeLuce is Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine. He joined us to talk about the controversy over National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's discussion of sanctions with a Russian ambassador before President Trump took office. When police officers encounter someone going through a mental health crisis, communication can be difficult and the situation may turn violent. Last summer, a mentally ill man engaging in threatening behavior was fatally shot by a Madison police officer. The city's current class of police recruits recently underwent a day of training to better understand the struggles faced by those with mental illness and how to best assist them.
WPR's Bridget Bowden has been following the recruits as they make their way through the police academy. She was on hand to observe the training, which included an exercise that simulated the effects of a mental health crisis.
During their block of training on mental health, Madison's 23 police recruits participate in an activity called Hearing Voices. The idea is to help them better understand what it's like to experience certain symptoms of mental illness. Recruit Claire Glady plugs earbuds into a red iPod. She hits play and starts to hear music. Then, voices.
Keep your eyes down now. Keep your eyes down.
Keeping the earbuds in, she completes a list of tasks, including a word search and simple counting. Then she takes a short verbal test.
I'm going to say 5 words. You don't have to repeat them to me now, but try to listen carefully. Cat, book, cigar, damage, rain.
But the questions are nearly impossible to answer because of the voices coming through her earbuds.
Name the last 4 presidents of the United States.
Barack Obama.
They're laughing at you. They know.
Bush.
So messed up.
Clinton. I have no idea.
The activity simulates auditory hallucinations that someone who has schizophrenia or is in psychosis might experience. Glady says she learned how difficult everyday life can be with these symptoms.
I experienced how hard it is, and now I don't share the experience. Obviously, it was just an exercise, but I have a better understanding of what it may be like to have that. I only had it for 10 minutes, so to have that for a lifetime would be very difficult.
Lindsay Wallace is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Dane County. She facilitated the exercise. Wallace hopes the recruits learned how difficult simple tasks can be if you are hearing voices.
I think it's, you know, part of what we're trying to do is show more empathy and compassion, and the best way to do that is to have them go through similar situations of what would it be like if somebody was talking in your ear constantly.
She spoke to the recruits about her own experience being hospitalized during a mental health crisis.
I am very surprised law enforcement wasn't called when I went through that stage, and so I think it's important for them to know that, you know, their first interaction with somebody is likely to be at that crisis level, and you're not the best person you can be when you're in crisis.
Sarah Henriksen is the law enforcement liaison for Journey Mental Health. She works with the MPD on crisis intervention and other mental health issues. She says she doesn't expect an officer to have the same level of expertise as a mental health clinician.
Just like I don't think we should expect our social workers to be tactically trained to disarm people from weapons, I don't think we should expect our police officers to be psychologists or clinical social workers or things like that.
In 2015, the MPD designated 5 people as full-time mental health officers. Instead of being out on patrol, they focus specifically on cases where mental health issues are involved. Andy Naylor is one of those officers.
I don't consider myself a mental health expert per se, in the sense that I don't diagnose people. I don't prescribe medication, that kind of thing, but I know who does.
He says a big part of his job is getting people connected to the resources they need. And for someone experiencing a mental health crisis, that could keep a potentially violent police interaction peaceful. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Bridget Bowden joins us now in the studio. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have a sense of how frequent an issue this is, dealing with mental health crises for a police department like the one in Madison?
Right. So police officers may encounter someone who's having a mental health crisis really a lot. So I don't know exactly how to put a number to encounters. But as far as emergency detentions for people who are needing to be taken to a treatment facility, I do have numbers. So last year in 2016, the Madison Police Department had a total of 196 emergency detentions.
And we heard in your piece there, nobody expects police officers to be fully trained mental health care professionals, but very often they may be the first point of contact between somebody dealing with a mental health crisis and the wider system. Does that put a lot of pressure on these recruits as they're considering these issues?
Absolutely. I mean, if you see someone on the street acting strangely, or you know, you have a loved one who seems to be having a mental health crisis, I think that most people would probably call 911, and the police would probably be the first people to show up. And so it is a lot of pressure because these recruits are having to learn a lot of things. You know, they're learning everything from how to make a traffic stop to how to disarm people tactically. And then you've got this mental health stuff on top of that. And you're right, they're not doctors. They're not physicians. They can't prescribe people medicine or make diagnoses. So...
And we heard that hearing voices exercise where they're trying to answer questions, not complicated questions, but while something like an auditory hallucination is being played for them. Did you try this one yourself? You've done, while you're embedded with the recruits, you've done some of these. Did you do this?
I did actually do this
activity. What was that like?
Yeah, I did this activity with the recruits, and it was very disorienting. So I had earbuds in, connected to a small iPod that played this track with all the voices. And we had to do a series of tasks, including a word search, and we had to go outside and count all the windows in the building. And then there was this test where we were asked simple questions like, can you remember these five words? Or who's the vice president? And yeah, having the voices in your head made it really difficult to focus on the task in front of you.
And so the idea from the recruit's point of view is if somebody isn't complying or seeming to make sense even, this might be one of the things they should consider. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think a big point of all of this training that they went through with mental health was just to try and plant the seed in their head that if they contact someone who seems to be acting strangely or maybe isn't communicating normally, that they should consider that this person might be having a mental health crisis or might have mental illness, and maybe they need to think about a different way to speak to that person or to behave around that person.
What other kind of things did they do in addition to that hearing voices exercise as part of this mental health training?
Yeah, they did a bunch of different things. So there was a psychiatrist who came in and really broke down the details of some common mental illnesses like schizophrenia and depression, and just told them about what the common signs of those diseases may be. They also had a panel discussion where a group of people who actually do have diagnosed mental illness came in and spoke to them about their mental illness and about different times that they've come in contact with the police. So I think that was really a big learning experience for a lot of the recruits, is getting to talk to people who actually have experienced this firsthand.
In that piece, you mentioned people who are five officers on the department who are trained as mental health officers. Can you tell us more about the role they'd play from day to day?
Sure. So these are officers who, instead of being out on patrol, you know, in a squad car taking calls and going to whatever calls, you know, might be out there, these are officers who are specifically assigned to cases that might have a mental health component. And there's also a group of officers called mental health liaisons that are out on patrol, but they also do additional work with mental illness.
So as you saw from this training, when someone with a mental health crisis ends up being arrested in Madison, what happens next to try to connect them with care or treatment?
Sure. It depends on the case. Certainly, at least the officers that I've talked to, Officer Andy Naylor, for example, one of the mental health officers, he, I think, would take every step that he could to connect that person with a resource that might be able to get them some help. But, you know, some people do end up needing to be taken into emergency detention.
And then where do they go? Is there a facility in Madison, or what happens then if they are detained?
Right. So the majority of these people end up having to be transported all the way up to Winnebago, because in 2014, the state ended most, with a few exceptions, they ended most civil commitments to the Mendota Mental Health Institute. So most of the emergency detentions are going up to Winnebago.
That's a trip. Are they trying to avoid doing that now? Are they trying to de-escalate instead of that sort of emergency commitment?
I mean, I think certainly in every case, de-escalation would be preferred to emergency detention. I don't think that it's possible in every case.
So you've covered a lot of ground following these recruits along, and there's a lot that they're learning here from the geography of the city that they'll be working in. As you mentioned, disarming people, basic police procedure, mental illness. It sounds overwhelming. Are you getting a sense that this is overwhelming for these recruits?
So the recruits have about a week and a half left in the academy, and they actually have a big test tomorrow, and that'll be their final written test in the police academy. So I do think that they have a lot that they have to learn, a lot of different topics to cover. But I think they're ready to take that test and get into field training. That'll be the next step. They'll go into field training.
And are you going to follow them into field training as part of this ongoing series?
So I'll be keeping up with them, you know, via phone and email. But unfortunately, I can't go, you know, ride along in a field training car because there's no room. Mm. They only have two seats.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us and providing us with this coverage.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Bridget Bowden, WPR's special projects reporter, talking with us about training undergone by Madison's current class of police recruits to better understand mental illness. According to a new poll released by Youth Justice Milwaukee, a majority of Wisconsinites would like to see fewer juvenile offenders sent to youth prisons, such as Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake.
The poll comes at a time when youth prisons in the state are under heightened scrutiny following allegations of abuse and neglect by guards at those facilities.
Jeff Roman joins us now to talk about the poll and the state of youth justice reform in Wisconsin. He's a member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us some more about the takeaways from this poll.
Well, yeah, I can talk about the takeaways about the poll. I think the most resounding thing that we're seeing is that there's been sort of a shifting in sort of ideas on what to do with young people who are having to face and be involved in the juvenile justice system. And so we're seeing an overwhelming majority of Wisconsinites who would rather see young people be provided with additional resources and supports for their neighborhoods and their families so that there are as alternatives, I should say, to going being sent to prison and being incarcerated.
And some of the specific questions ask things like, even in cases where they are incarcerated, should they be within a certain number of miles of home? Should their families have access to them? And that seems like it's generating a contrast with the current situation where especially youth offenders from Milwaukee are way far north, pretty far away from home.
Right. Yeah, and I think all the data leads to, and all the data and research is showing us that pro-social development is important for young people. A young person's brain is still developing up until even age 24 and 25. And so a part of the development process is about pro-social development, making sure that there are linkable or tangible linkages to family and community and sort of the customs and traditions of those communities that where they're growing up in. And if we're talking about rehabilitating young people, those same things apply. The pro-social development with family members, the being able to be exposed to resources and different things in those communities are part of a young person's development. And when you take those things away, we're not creating remedy. We're actually just doing punishment. And we all know that punishment is not a remedy. And so in order to be really rehabilitative and really help to transform and transcend some of the things that our young people are doing, we have to make sure that they have access to family members and positive supports from those they're familiar with.
There's this ongoing investigation by the FBI now, though it's not clear exactly what stage they're at, looking at Wisconsin's current main youth juvenile corrections facilities, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, allegations of abuse, neglect, not providing classes for kids. These are also supposed to be schools. What do you make of the current state of affairs, what we have now in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's just symptomatic of a failed model that the current juvenile justice youth prison system that we have here in Wisconsin and across the nation just doesn't work. It's an outdated, failed model that's disproportionately based on biases and disparities, racial disparities. There are proven practices and proven models that are working now, given the culture and the context of our community now, where there are different considerations that we have that we need to give young people, particularly around the research that's emerging around brain development, pro-social development, that a lot of our prisons, because they're so outdated, they're not really, they're not subscribing to a lot of those theories of changes now. And so it's an outdated model. That's an outdated model that does not work. That's really, really costly, and much more focused on punishment than on rehabilitation.
I will get into some of the alternatives that exist and that you think we need in a bit. But I want to talk about incarceration. I think a lot of people look at it as, yes, a last resort. But I've heard from people in the justice system who say we've got some young offenders who really need to be incarcerated. They're committing violent crimes. Even the best rehabilitation systems that we have don't seem to be working. Do we need some kind of last resort incarceration? Maybe something better than Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake, mm-hmm. but something.
Yeah, and I think that it's a question of accountability. This is not a conversation, or the work that we're doing is not a conversation about the lack of accountability. It's about really looking at the way we're holding young people accountable now today, and the ways that we do that are not in the best interest of their development, and it's also not in the best interest of the communities from which they're coming from. There are young people who do need additional levels or additional supports, and sometimes those supports do need to be in secure settings where they are safe, where they can be safe themselves or safe from themselves, and then where our communities can be safe and be safe from those young people. But the way that we're doing it now just doesn't work. And I think data from not only Wisconsin but from all over the country shows that what we're doing with young people in our juvenile justice system across the country just does not work. Over a high percentage of young people within 3 years of recidivate back into the system. And a lot of times that leads to a pipeline right into the adult system. And so if we're seeing that amount of young people going back into the system, that's proof there that the system has to take some accountability in the ways that it is contributing to the rate of recidivism of young people going back into the system.
Talking to Jeff Roman from the group Youth Justice Milwaukee, they have a poll out showing a lot of support for alternatives for reform of juvenile justice and a sentiment to avoid incarceration where possible, and if incarceration is needed, to keep it closer to home, more access to family and community. Jeff, let's talk about some of the alternatives that might be in place, say, in an area like Milwaukee now. What positive signs do you see in the community?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of positive signs. I think what gets lost in the conversation, especially here in communities like Milwaukee, is that these young people are coming from a community that lack resources, that lack interest and genuine care for these young people, and that there are not experts and expertise in the communities from these young people come from. We know that simply is not isn't true here in Milwaukee and in other places around the country. There are organizations and individuals who are working with young people before they go into the system, as they are coming out, and working with their families, and have real tangible linkages and real life experience that relate to the young people. And the better that we can lift those organizations up and extend or scale the work that they're doing, the better results and outcomes we're going to have for young people here in Milwaukee. And there are a lot of examples of that work happening here and in other counties across the state that we can look to. To be able to really transform the way that we think about and deploy youth justice here in Milwaukee.
Now, according to the poll that your organization released, there's a pretty substantial majorities of people who support efforts like the ones you're talking about and trying for rehabilitation first before incarceration. Do you see that translating at the policy level into support, into financial commitment to that kind of approach?
I think there are serious conversations that are happening in at decision-making tables with our policymakers, not only at the state level, but across the state, at the county, and at some of the municipal levels as well. And I think the report, the polling that was released just recently from the Youth First Initiative and Youth Justice Milwaukee really speaks to and gives some validity to some of the conversations that are happening. A lot of times we make decisions as decision-makers and policymakers without sufficient information, sufficient data. And we have proof now, and we have, you know, documented proof, attitudinal proof of people here in Wisconsin who are saying in large numbers that they prefer to really have a real conversation about alternatives to incarceration based on a number of factors.
I want to talk to you about what we know about what works at various steps along the way. And you mentioned the phrase, you know, before a kid is in the system. Are there things that we know, interventions that we know that can keep kids from that first interaction, from that first crime that makes them part of the criminal justice system?
Sure. There are a number of things. And a lot of the work that we do is focus on the ACEs, the Adverse Child Experiences, and trauma-informed care. And we know that that is an emerging field of not only theory, but of practice that's really has gained a lot of traction here in Milwaukee. And there are a number of programs and a number of organizations who apply sort of the practices of trauma-informed care just to figure out, you know, it's not a question of why did you do something or really why it gets to why did you do something instead of just trying to, you know, hold you accountable right away. We want to really go deeper and really figure out why, what's led to, you know, why you are here, why you've done, or why there are certain behaviors that you're having. There's a reason for everything.
We've heard the phrase trauma-informed care a lot in Wisconsin lately from First Lady Tonette Walker, and her husband, Governor Scott Walker, mm-hmm. has mentioned that himself. Are you encouraged by that kind of talk at a high level in Wisconsin government?
I'm encouraged that the conversations are happening, and I mean, I want to give credit where credit is due, that both Governor Walker and his wife have been doing some really significant work here in Milwaukee around trauma-informed care. I don't think that, I think there's more work for other decision makers to do. Just having a conversation is just one part of the process. We have to take those conversations and apply those to actual policy decisions and funding decisions that really impact the words that we're seeing.
We're talking to Jeff Roman. He's a member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. He's with us to talk about a new poll from that group that shows a majority of Wisconsinites are in favor of taking a lot of different steps to keep young people out of youth prisons, like Copper Lake or Lincoln Hills.
And we want to hear from you. What reforms would you like to see in the state? Should Wisconsin maintain a zero-tolerance approach or come up with a different way to punish young people who commit crimes? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you are part of this story, if you or someone you know has been part of the youth justice system as an offender, as somebody getting rehabilitation, working in that system, especially like to hear from you. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time.
We're talking to Jeff Roman of Youth Justice Milwaukee right now about new poll that shows a majority of Wisconsin residents would prefer to see young people who commit crimes rehabilitated instead of being sent to youth prisons like Copper Lake or Lincoln Hills.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on our youth justice system here in Wisconsin? If you went through the youth prison system in the state, what did you take away from your time there? If you're a parent whose child has gone through the system in one way or another, what impact did that have on your family? If you work in this, in a correctional facility yourself, in the justice system, as a police officer, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Bonnie is with us in Waukesha. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if any of the youth offenders get medical checkups right away, because I know that oftentimes there are medical problems that can lead to violence, like if there's a thyroid problem, people with thyroid problems frequently become tending toward violence, and once they're under treatment for their thyroid problem, they become much less violent.
Thanks for the call, Bonnie. And let's widen that even, Jeff. I mean, are there things that look into maybe a medical problem like that, maybe a mental health needing treatment, other problems that might be maybe an underlying cause of criminal activity?
Yeah, and there are, to speak to what's offered within the actual facilities, we do know that there are mandates for healthcare provision and for various screening processes to, you know, assess where young people are mentally and cognitively and behaviorally, and those, that's a part of the screening process when young people are sent through the system into the correctional facilities. I think our position is that those screening tools and the tools that are being used can be updated, can be more reflective of some of the cognitive behavioral kind of strategies or methods that are in existence today. For example, the trauma-informed care and the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences assessment tools. We're not sure of the extent to which those are being used and to the extent that those are being sort of applied in the correctional facility. But I think it leads to a bigger question. To what extent are the correctional facilities in the state engaging really the expertise from experts in those fields, but also expertise from the communities to inform what those strategies should be? And we think that the way that engagement is happening desperately needs to be heightened up and broadened.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to David with us in Hayward. David, hi.
Yeah, I wanted to comment as a parent that I think following a period of incarceration, if an offense requires that, you know, that given that sort of resource put into a juvenile offender, they should be followed in the community in a little tighter way to ensure that they would get education or a job skill, something to start to be a participator in community, rather than be just, you know, out of jail or out of prison and then on their own again. I think that promotes recidivism, and I think if they had a tighter connection with gaining some skills to take care of themselves better, this is just common sense in my view, essential. I don't think it's happening.
David, thanks for the call. Is it happening, Jeff, some kind of help transitioning out of incarceration for, this comes up for older offenders, but for young offenders in particular?
Yeah, I think it goes to the question of scale and to the development of more culturally responsive and culturally appropriate strategies that are being used. We do know that there are various services that young people and their families do receive as they are coming back into or being integrated back into the community. I believe that there are a number of additional providers and other strategies that could be used and scaled to be able to better support those young people. And those need to be incorporated incorporated into the individual plans with the young people as they are inside the facility and as they are coming out. And so that what we like to call a soft transition after being released. And so the resources do exist. It's a question of scaling and really making sure that they're culturally appropriate for the young people.
Thanks for the call. We're talking about the youth justice system and alternatives to incarceration with Jeff Roman from Youth Justice Milwaukee. Back to our callers. Stacy is on the line in Portage. Stacy, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling as a consumer, and also I happen to be a provider of services. I work with at-risk kids, and unfortunately, I have a kiddo who has been an at-risk kid through no fault of our own. That he experienced a lot of trauma, and I did a lot of things to try to keep him out of trouble. But the services they kind of aren't there until you're already in trouble. No matter how much a parent begs and needs it, right now the system is very reactive, and I think anybody in Child Protective Services or juvenile justice can agree with that you can't get the help until it's too late. Fortunately for us, my son was able to go to Rawhide as opposed to, something a bit more punitive and less restorative. And, there's been a lot of time and energy poured into us, and I am so thankful because my son is not lost. And if we hadn't have had that, if it had just been punitive, even though I knew he was in there, I needed the help to keep him from,
a worse future.
Stacey, thanks so much. Good luck to him and the kids you work with, for that matter. Jeff, to her first point there, service is not there, she says, until there's a crisis, not before there's a crisis.
And I think that's that. I think that is the point that I want you all to leave with, is that we do have a very reactive system, and unfortunately, the resources that do exist, they are for those who have been involved within the system. I think that again shows that the model that we are using, our justice model for young people that we're using, is fundamentally outdated and flawed, in that it does not consider the preventative things that need to be in place and really invest on the front end of providing supports to young people, their families, and the communities that they come from, so that we don't have to invest the millions of dollars that we invest on the back end to incarcerate them, and then to provide minimal services on the back end.
Stacey, thanks. Erica is with us now in Kewaskum. Hi, Erica.
Hi. I had previously worked as an AODA counselor in the local jail and for adolescents, and it wasn't necessarily because they had AODA-related offenses, but...
It's alcohol or other drugs, right?
Right. A lot of them, unfortunately, were in there, you know, several times because they just really didn't even mind being in there, and getting to know them, a lot of them... came from houses that, you know, they didn't have the kind of support that they needed in order to have thought patterns otherwise. You know, they didn't care that they were doing these things and getting in trouble, because a lot of times their parents were doing the same. And, you know, they definitely need the support, like rehabilitation-wise, in order to make some sort of change in their life.
Erica, thanks for the call. Jeff, is there help out there for parents who maybe are going through similar things that their kids are going through in the justice system?
I think that's a fair question. And I think the reality is, just as we talk about the minimal resources for young people, there needs to be an increase in resources for parents on the front end, and working with parents to get the supports that they need. I think what we're seeing, what we are seeing, especially in communities like Milwaukee, is that we have a relatively young population of people who are having children at a younger age, or had been having children at a younger age, that contributes to the context of what we see today, which tells me that we need to be working with our policymakers and decision makers again on really scaling the resources and investment that we put into supports on the front end, prevention and family support and in education, like the other caller said, and making sure that there are opportunities for economic development and business creation and growth in communities like Milwaukee that are deterrents to the symptoms that we see, violence and the various things that leads to young people being incarcerated.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jeff Roman with Youth Justice Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a new poll just released showing a majority of Wisconsinites would like to see young people who commit crimes kept out of youth prisons, things like Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills.